All right, so last time we talked about the project of natural theology, and we looked at various strategies. We want to spend most of our time on the cosmological argument, or I should say arguments in the plural, because there are a variety of versions. You've got to think in terms of the whole and in terms of subsets. So we come back to subsets with the Kalam argument. But you might think of the whole apologetic for Christianity. You should view this as a cumulative case. The case accumulates. You have arguments for truth, arguments for God, arguments for the reliability of the Bible, arguments against naturalism, against pantheism, against polytheism. That's the big picture, the overall apologetic. Within that, you have subsections or subsets. And one subset is natural theology, or what are sometimes called theistic proofs. But they don't have to be deductive proofs. They're just good arguments better than the alternatives. Now, within that subset, you have cosmological arguments. And you have different types of cosmological arguments. We'll talk about arguments that rely on empirical evidence from science, and we'll talk about the Kalam argument, and we'll talk about more of a Thomistic argument, and briefly mention a Leibnizian argument. So there are a lot of different categories and subcategories. But we're still worried a little bit about people who want to stop the project at the beginning. And we dealt with the claim that belief in God is intrinsically irrational because God, by definition, is invisible. And there's no good reason to believe in anything that is invisible. Now, we talked about various ways of responding to this. It seems to be a category mistake. God, by definition, is not intrinsically visible. God may manifest himself through various signs. But don't we know things that are invisible? And I talked about knowing certain values. Certain things are objectively true. Torturing the innocent for pleasure, merely for pleasure, is always wrong. That's true, but that's not something in the visible realm. We know that through, you might say, common sense or intuition. Now, you might say, well, a person is different than a value. Sure. But all we're trying to say is that it is rational in some cases to believe in something invisible. That's all you really need to defeat this claim that it's always wrong to believe in something that's invisible. God is invisible, therefore there's no reason to believe in God. This comes out of a kind of crass empiricism. In fact, the statement, you should only believe what is visible, is itself not visible. It's comprised of propositions. You might say it's audible. You could write it down, and the signs you use to express the proposition would be visible. But there are a lot of things that are invisible. The mind, values, subatomic particles, and so on. Now, what about the projection theory? This notion is that God is nothing but a projection of the religious imagination. There are various versions of this by Feuerbach. Feuerbach said that human beings take what is the best about the human and make it infinite and create the notion of God. Marx claimed that religion was a compensatory mechanism whereby oppressed peoples console themselves and whereby the oppressors oppress them. So his famous statement is that religion is the opiate of the masses and nothing more. Freud argued that the notion of God is an illusion. It comes out of our desires, out of our wishes. It's nothing but wish fulfillment. We live in a cruel universe. Death threatens, decay threatens. Those we trust the most may let us down. So we have the idea of a father, and a father being benevolent and having authority, at least ideally. So we assume, or rather we project this idea onto reality in order to console us or comfort us. So really, there is no referent. There is no objective existence for God. God is merely wish fulfillment, like the tooth fairy or Santa Claus. And to this day, you often hear atheists put God in that category as if they had succeeded in some kind of very powerful argument. Now, all you have to do here is, if you want to play the psychology game, is turn the tables and say that atheists have a cosmic authority problem. And in fact, there is some pretty good empirical evidence for this with respect to Nietzsche and Freud and others who had terrible relationships with their father, or their fathers. In the case of Nietzsche, died at a young age. He was raised by his mother and by his aunts. So you can just turn the tables and do the same thing, and it equally begs the question. The question is whether or not you have good philosophical arguments for theism or atheism. It really has very little to do with the desires of individual subjects. So you have to distinguish what you might call the psychology of discovery from the epistemology of justification. It could be that someone is drawn to belief in God in order to fill a gap left by their absent father. Or it could be they hate the idea of God because they hate their father. But the issue really is not the psychology of the subject, it's whether there is good independent evidence for the existence or non-existence of God. Now, you can turn it around in another sense and claim that the yearning for transcendence, you have to be very general here, the yearning for transcendence in the human condition indicates something about reality, that we have a deep hunger for reality beyond ourselves. And it would be strange if so many over the eons had this sense of incompleteness and hunger and emptiness, and there be no object to fulfill it. That's C.S. Lewis's argument from desire. You can develop that kind of an argument, but you need to supplement it with other more objective arguments from the cosmos, from morality, from design, and so on. The projection argument also fails, at least with respect to Christianity, because there are a lot of features, I think, about the Christian revelation that are not very comfortable, that are not things that people would simply want to be true and therefore believe. Some of the strictures that Jesus lays down about inner virtue, lust of the eyes, and so on. The doctrine of eternal punishment of the unrepentant is not a doctrine that I relish. I believe it because Jesus taught it. And I believe he's the ultimate authority, and there is a logic to it. So there are elements within the Christian worldview that don't really fit this idea of projecting that which you wish to be true. Really, what this tends to do is assume there's no objective evidence for God and then try to explain why so many bumpkins believe in God. And that's called begging the question. So really, don't worry about this argument too much. It's not a strong argument. Now, if there was no good, strong, positive support for Christian theism, then this argument would begin to take off. But we will argue that there is very good support for the existence of a creator of the universe who designed it and who is the source of the moral law. And there's good arguments for the reliability of Scripture, the deity of Christ, the resurrection, and so on. Questions or comments on that? Simply because you desire something to be true doesn't mean it's false, and it doesn't mean it's true. There are more factors to consider here. All right, anyone ever been plagued by this argument, or you've had this argument used on you? Yeah. Oftentimes it's the crutch argument. It's a version of it. People who are weak need to believe in God, so they believe in God, but there is no God. Which begs another question, which is whether or not we are objectively weak, whether or not we are objectively in need of a source of guidance and morality and even salvation outside of ourselves. If we are, it makes perfectly good sense to make use of that, if you will, crutch. Because without it, we're crippled. So again, that's the kind of an argument that begs the question. Questions or comments on that? Yes.
Would some use the doctrine of hell and final judgment to say that we created that to put pressures on society to form the beliefs that we want, and that therefore causes this projection argument?
Well, I suppose you could refine it in such a way that that's the case, but it doesn't really function that way in Christianity. Anyone who's not rightly related to Christ is in danger of hell. Anyone, including people that profess belief. So it really raises the stakes tremendously for everyone. So I don't think that you can probably construe it as a projection. Now, you could create a doctrine of hell that's unbiblical, which would be a projection. And the Bible is actually quite concerned about projection theories of religion. They're called idols. So anytime you worship the true God in the wrong way, or you try to create God in your own image by hacking off attributes you don't like and adding attributes that you do, you're suffering from some kind of projection dysfunction or malfunction. So the concept is very fruitful, and the prophets in the Bible use it repeatedly to expose false religion. But can you reduce religion to those levels? No, you can't. You can't reduce all of it to that. Moreover, I mean, briefly, with respect to Marx, religion can be used to pacify the socially oppressed, but if you look at Christianity, if you look at the prophets, particularly Amos and others, if you look at the teachings of John the Baptist and Jesus, you'll see that the teachings challenge the status quo. They give comfort to the oppressed, but they also call the powerful to account. So Christianity, rightly construed and rightly applied, by no means supports social injustice, although it can be abused in that way. So the invisibility argument fails, the projection argument fails. What would a good theistic argument do? It would give us strong evidence or strong clues in the creation that leads to the Creator, would help verify a worldview hypothesis in various ways, part of a cumulative case argument. We want to give a better explanation for the nature and meaning of the universe than rival views, and the key rivals would be naturalism, pantheism, and polytheism. And ultimately, with respect to theism, non-Trinitarian theism like Unitarianism and Islam and Judaism. It would also, if successful, and we'll begin this project in a moment, provide incentive for the seeker to look into Christianity. That is Christian theism the true theism? Let's say someone's impressed by cosmological design moral arguments. They may then develop a new and heightened interest in the Bible itself. If someone's a dyed-in-the-wool atheist and you push the Bible on them, let's say it's just a collection of myths and legends created by people who believed in God because they didn't know any better. If someone believes in the existence of a creator, then the Bible is a potential revelation of that creator. And someone might be much more interested to look into it. Now, someone may go from atheism in one step to Christian theism if they read the scripture and the power and the beauty and the truth of the scripture captivates them. That's possible. God is free to convert us and convict us in any number of ways, certainly. But if you're talking about the best structure of an argument, I think if you're dealing with an atheist, the good place to start is, does the universe give us strong evidence for the existence of something outside of the universe that is a first cause, a designer, a source of the moral law? Okay, questions or comments about the basic structure of natural theology, what it can do, why we should attempt it? All right. Let me talk briefly about some problems with atheism and agnosticism. I think we know pretty much what theism is. I have to part company with Wynne Corduin again in the book. He says that atheism is unprovable, and he uses the unicorn example. And you hear Ravi Zacharias sometimes give this argument, and other people give this argument. They say atheism is the attempt to prove a universal negative. That is, there is exactly no God. And the notion is that it's very difficult, if not impossible, to prove a universal negative. And people sometimes say, you can't be everywhere in the universe at the same time to falsify the existence of God, because maybe God is somewhere where you aren't. Have you ever heard this argument? It's a crummy argument. Corduin uses the example of a unicorn, amazingly to me. Says, well, we have the concept of a unicorn, and we can't rationally disprove that there are unicorns because there might be one somewhere that we have not yet observed. Okay, that's logically possible, but there's still no strong positive reason to believe it. Now, with God, you don't have to be everywhere in the universe at the same time to come up with a good argument against God's existence. That's not how it works. A good argument against God's existence would probably say that all the positive arguments fail. And if you read Michael Martin, his book on atheism, he takes all the positive arguments and he says they all fail. Then he gives arguments for atheism, for materialism. It has nothing to do with being everywhere at the universe at once. In fact, if the problem of evil works, Christianity is false just by the fact that there is objective evil in the world, or that there is so much objective evil in the world. That is, if God is all good and all powerful and all knowing, God would not allow either any evil or as much evil as we now see. And so we're left with maybe a finite God or no God. That has nothing to do with being everywhere at the universe at the same time. Now, friends, don't worry. I don't think any of those arguments work. But atheism is potentially provable, given a certain kind of argument. It's not intrinsically unprovable. Now, you might say, well, it's very difficult to establish a universal negative in certain empirical cases. Yes, it is. Let's say you have a haystack and you have the claim there's exactly one needle in that haystack. You know, proving that there's no needle is going to be a lot of work. Right? Now, you could find the needle right away. But it's harder to show there's no needle than there is a needle. You have to go through the whole haystack to show that there's none. You just have to go through maybe part of it, unless it's the last place possible to look, to show there is one. So these kind of evidential situations obtain. For instance, a friend of my mother's once told me that the Bible claims that God helps those who help themselves. And I said, the Bible does not claim that. And he goes, oh, I know it's in there somewhere. Now, the Bible's a big book. How do I disprove it to the guy? Go through every page and read it to him, or tell him to read every page? You have to basically base it on authority. I'd say, look, I've read the whole thing. It's not there. And a lot of other people have read the whole thing. They'll tell you it's not there. And you could do a computer search now. It'd be easier. Okay. So in some cases, proving a negative is harder, or maybe even impossible, proving it. But with atheism, it's really not the same category. So we want as many good arguments as possible in our repertoire, but we don't want to include any bad arguments. Now, it's even possible that the very concept of God is impossible. If the concept of God is internally contradictory, then it can't be true. And some people have, I think, weakly tried to show that. They try to pit the omni attributes against each other. Not many atheists try that anymore. But some might say that the existence of God is tantamount to the existence of a square circle, or 2 plus 2 equals 5, that it's impossible. Now, for something to be possible, the concept has to be intelligible. So what we need to do in explaining the Christian hypothesis is to explain what we mean by a God who is personal, moral, all good, all powerful, omnipresent, and so on, and show that those are not contradictory claims. They don't fight with each other, as it were. And some people have claimed that they do, but I think if you construct them carefully enough, they don't. For instance, people would say the concept of omnipotence is self-contradictory because can God make a rock so heavy he can't lift it? You know, if he can't do it, that's something he can't do. And if he can do it, it's something he can't do. So either way, there's a problem because you're setting up a condition that God cannot fulfill, but God is all-powerful, so he can't be all-powerful, you see, because he is a condition he can't fulfill. Now, the way of dealing with that is to say it's nonsense. It makes no sense to stipulate a condition by which an omnipotent being can't do something. So there is no such possible object. So there's no problem. So a lot of these things just dissolve. And frankly, the apologetic battles in the street and in the church are probably not over the coherence internally of the idea of God. But if the concept ends up being incoherent, it cannot obtain. An incoherent concept cannot be instantiated. We know there are no square circles. You don't have to do any empirical investigation. Right? We know 2 plus 2 cannot equal 5. We know that every triangle has exactly three sides. Those are our logical truths. They're rational truths. So if you can say that conceptual system X is internally contradictory, it cannot be true. That's a way to sink any worldview right at the beginning, conceptually. If something is internally inconsistent, it cannot be instantiated. Now, what is a unicorn? Is a unicorn internally incoherent as a concept? No, why not? Yeah.
Well, there are animals that do have one horn. There are only two horns, like goats, like if they're horns twisted into one horn.
Yeah, there's nothing physically or logically impossible about a horse-like being with exactly one horn. It's not like a square circle. Okay? It's not like a pro-life Democratic candidate for president. It's not anything like that. So the issue is what's instantiated and what is not instantiated. Now, Cordwin talks a little bit about atheism being contrary to human nature, and I'm going to bracket that pretty much. What he's arguing is that atheists often live on borrowed capital. And we need to spend more time on this argument. The argument is that human beings typically assume a moral meaning to the universe, whether they're atheists or theists or whatever. And when an atheist assumes the moral meaning of the universe, that things have purposes, that they're objective moral properties, they're believing something in contradiction to their atheism. And they're simply positing it without any justification, without any warrant, without any backup intellectually. And we need to spend more time on this later because we'll try to develop a moral argument for the existence of God. We've already argued against relativism. So we'll come back to that a little bit later. Now, some people do try to bite the bullet and say that they're nihilists, that there is no meaning, there are no moral propositions that are true. It's all relative, and no one has any authority above anyone else. So everything is permitted. Nothing can be judged as immoral or vicious. Some people do bite the bullet on that, but not too many. But there are atheists who would say, no, we can have objective moral values without God. They're just there. They're just immaterial parts of the universe that have no explanation. Now, that's a very implausible idea, but we have to come back to that later. An atheist obviously cannot root moral values in the existence of God or in human nature created by God, because there are no such things. But she may or may not believe in objective moral values. If she doesn't, and still starts asserting that some things are absolutely evil and some things are absolutely wrong, then she's living off of borrowed capital. And it's very important to show people when they're not living up to their worldview. When in one part of the worldview they say P and another part they say not P. Okay, when their worldview is internally incoherent. We need to point that out to people. Yes?
Would these be people that would argue that they would read the Bible because it has some good ideas in it, moral truths, but not necessarily that God is true?
They might. They might say that the Bible contains certain aspects of human wisdom, but there's no need to believe it's a divine revelation. So the Bible has limited instrumental value without endorsing theism.